Behan was part of the society that essentially hijacked the image of a city whose racial and cultural diversity fascinated memoirists and travel writers before and after the war. The resurgence of white power, enshrined in the 1891 erection of the White League obelisk, had long-lasting impact through the 20th century. It kept black children out of good schools. It kept black citizens out of jobs. It condemned them to poor housing, terrible health care, and poverty. And I again recalled, many talented African Americans simply left the city. Louis Armstrong left. He even refused to be buried here. My education came late, but it caught up with me in a hurry. We can be proud of our ancestors who served the Confederacy as men who fought courageously for a cause larger than themselves. We can also recognize that in the context of history, they were wrong, which is to say, they were human. Slavery was the reason for the war, as we learn in unblinkered histories. Southerners, protecting their open-quote, close-quote, traditional way of life, committed horrendous moral crimes against people of African descent. And yet, in 1884, when the Lee statue was installed, the Daily Picayune captured a mindset of prevailing power. Open quote. We cannot ignore the fact that the secession has been stigmatized as treason and that the purest and bravest men in the South have been denounced as guilty of shameful crime. By every application of literature and art, we must show to all coming ages that with us, at least, there dwells no sense of guilt. Close quote. The cult of the lost cause succeeded. I decided that this sanitizing of history must end. The monuments do not represent history, nor the soul of New Orleans. They were not tools for teaching. Instead, they were the product of a warped political movement by wealthy people, supporting a mayor who was determined to regain power for white people, to reduce blacks to second-class status, and to control how history was seen, read, and accepted by whites. As the mayor of this multicultural city, trying to rebuild not as it was, but the way it should have always been, I concluded that Winton was right. They should come down. They are not of our age, nor of our making, and they deserve no prominence in our city. So here I am, in my second term, thinking, if anyone can get rid of those symbols, it's me. A future African-American mayor would face an excruciating struggle with this because of the way power and money undulate in this city. It would turn into an ugly referendum on race with the voices of a sentimental South that stands on the whitewashed history raising a protest about heritage and honor, not slavery. I thought my team was good enough to bring people together to achieve a reconciliation, a way of putting the past to rest. Should we really be debating the Civil War in 2017? Something else was digging at me. If William Behan, who was mayor from 1882 to 1884, and participated in erecting a monument in 1891, did something that insults and demeans a great portion of my citizens, then it is my responsibility as mayor to course correct and challenge that version of history that prominent scholars have found specious, the notion of a chivalrous South that lost the war for noble reasons. Many claim that many white Southerners went off to war in the belief that they had to defend their homeland. But it was the politicians and their generals who determined whether a war should be fought and why. Alexander H. Stephens, the vice president of the Confederate States, in a March 21, 1861 speech at Macon, Georgia, said of the new government, the Southern states, open quote, its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests, upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world, based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. With us, all of the white race, however high or low, rich or poor, are equal in the eye of the law. Not so with the Negro. Subordination is his place. He, by nature, or by the curse against Canaan, is fitted for that condition which he occupies in our system. Close quote. The Union, led by President Lincoln, did not want a slave economy, and prevailed in the war over that issue. But winning the war hardly settled the matter or secured equality and opportunity for black Americans. Reconstruction turned into a nightmare of terrorism against black people by southern white potentates. Reconstruction eventually gave us the statues. When I'm processing a lot of this information, I'm also thinking legally. For a short period of time, I am the steward of a government that began in 1718. I'm a lawyer, and the research by my staff and the city attorney is conclusive. The city government had control over that property. Behan put up that Liberty Place monument, and I could take it down. In truth, the White League obelisk had become an embarrassment even to many whites. When the black majority city council in 1993 declared it a public nuisance and ordered it removed, it precipitated a legal appeal from diehard traditionalists in federal court under the false guise of historical preservation. The upshot was that the city moved the obelisk from its prominent place on Canal Street to an obscure spot behind the Aquarium of the Americas next to a parking garage. My city budget had to pay again and again to clean anti-racist graffiti off the White League monument, a symbol that flaunted the constitutional principle of equal protection under the law. City ordinances reflect the evolution of a government, its constituents, and their needs. The city council, under the New Orleans Code, had defined a public nuisance, and I quote, "The thing honors, praises, or fosters ideologies which are in conflict with the requirements of equal protection for citizens as provided by the Constitution and laws of the United States, the state, or laws of the city, and gives honor or praise to those who participated in the killings of public employees of the city or the state, or suggest the supremacy of one ethnic, religious, or racial group over any other, or gives honor or praise to any violent actions taken wrongfully against citizens of the city to promote ethnic, religious, or racial supremacy of any group over another." Close quote. It was clear to me that this spoke directly to the monuments, and that the city's authority over its public spaces took precedent over a designation of national historic significance. We could remove the statues of Lee, Davis, Beauregard, and the White League under this ordinance. I would need the support of a majority of the 7-member city council. I felt that if I laid the political groundwork, we could achieve this. We were in early 2015 now. I thought about how beautiful it would be to have a fountain with a swirl of colors atop the 60-foot column to supplant the icon of General Lee. We would send out a request for proposals to distinguished sculptors and artists, appoint a blue ribbon committee to choose the design, and with enough lead time, we would have a world-class monument by 2018 during the tricentennial events. New Orleans has always been more progressive than most southern cities, by virtue of our diversity and our festive culture, centered around carnival in winter and jazz and heritage festival in the spring. Whites are a voting minority, but there is a cordiality in civic affairs as the eccentric, colorful nature of the town draws residents to the proverbial public square with a passion for the city as a unique place, one that puts a great premium on enjoying life. I realize that for many whites, Lee Circle was a place that had always been there, a familiar piece of the urban fabric, a landmark like streetcars, with a small park around the base of the monument where people navigated bad traffic patterns and watched Mardi Gras parades. As tolerant as New Orleanians are in many respects, I knew that a move to change the traditional cityscape would involve a good deal of retail politics. Call on key people, brief them, generate support for the plan. One of the first people I spoke with about taking down the Robert E. Lee statue was my father. Moon Landrieu was in his mid-80s, an active walker around Audubon Park. He and my mother still lived in the house I grew up in on Priya Street with several grandchildren in residence while they're in law school or college. I briefed him on what I wanted to do. "Son, I'm not sure I'd do that," he said gently. "That would be a big fight." He was speaking to me as a father, concerned for my career and future. I sensed that he understood the importance of removing Confederate icons, but was concerned about the personal and political fallout on me. I love my father, but I was on a determined course, and I had a sneaking suspicion that he would do the same thing if he was standing in my shoes at this moment. I was raised at his knee, and I know him as well as he knows me. This was the guy who, in 1960, was one of only two white legislators to vote against a powerful segregationist package. And so, I ignored his parental advice. What did Robert E. Lee, who allegedly spent one night in New Orleans, actually do for this city, compared to Louis Armstrong, Fats Domino, Tennessee Williams, the Marsalis family, the Neville family, Anne Rice? How many names do I need? The Civil War was about slavery, and yet Robert E. Lee was being celebrated in our most prominent space. Whenever I had second thoughts, I went back to two separate numbers. 6,615,000. 6 million is the approximate number of human beings who were enslaved in our exceptional country until 1865. 6 million. Look at it and say it again. You can see it. You can see them. These 6 million included men, women, children, many of whom were beaten, raped, tortured, hung like fruit, forced to work against their will, their families torn apart. 615,000. This is the number of soldiers who died in the war that we waged against ourselves. Feel this number deeply. One side to save the nation and end slavery, the other to destroy the nation as we knew it and to preserve slavery. No one was left unscarred. The first shot of the Civil War was fired on Fort Sumter on April 12, 1861, by Confederate soldiers under the command of P.G.T. Beauregard. His future general was Robert E. Lee, and their self-proclaimed president was Jefferson Davis. They fought against the United States of America to preserve the institution of slavery. They lost. But 615,000 Americans also lost their lives in this fight to preserve the Union. 6 million human beings were enslaved in our country. The largest number of those human beings was sold into slavery in my city, New Orleans. There is good and evil, right and wrong, truth and falsehood. The false narrative that has taken hold, a perpetual state of denial that has been left unchecked, has strangled the South that I love and made us weaker as a nation. In hindsight, I wished I'd explained it in terms more Southerners might understand better. SEC football. The Civil War was not an LSU versus Alabama game. The Confederacy wasn't just a game with each side suiting up in their jerseys for the weekend. It was a war to keep slavery. There should be no doubt that the Confederacy was on the wrong side of humanity and history. As a country, we ought to be at the point now, in the year 2018, where we can recognize the basic truth that slavery was wrong, accept it, and figure out the appropriate way to remember it, but not to revere it. I wanted to get in touch with major figures from all communities who had supported me in the past and seek their backing for a fountain to replace the Lee statue. The first person I visited was a white businesswoman and a philanthropist in New Orleans. As she sat listening, I explained the genesis of my project, the conversation with Wenton, and the due diligence I had made the city undergo in determining legal ownership of the spaces. She did not warm to the idea. In conveying her position, she never raised her voice, nor said an angry word. She probably could have stopped the project had she taken a stance of militant opposition, begun making calls, and spoken out in public. She did not, and I am grateful for that. She was gracious, but I left the meeting feeling pretty low. I called Walter Isaacson and recounted my discussions with both her and with Wenton. "I agree with Wenton," said Isaacson. He went on, "They ought to come down. The monuments don't really represent New Orleans." I then said, "I can't do this by myself. You guys are going to have to speak up publicly." He said he would. Both Isaacson and Marsalis eventually wrote op-ed pieces backing my decision. I called Ken Burns, director of the PBS series The Civil War, which had taught so many about the realities of that war. I told him what I had learned, the dilemma that I faced, and asked him if I was off course. "No," said Burns, "I think you're on the right track." Actually, I was moving along two tracks, sounding out people involved in the tricentennial planning and meeting with financial supporters of my campaigns and major projects for New Orleans, hoping to generate a budget to build a fountain after the General Lee statue was taken down. On March 18, 2015, I gathered the Tricentennial's Executive Committee and top historians on New Orleans. The Tricentennial's Historic and Cultural Advisory Committee included Sybil Morial, who had been First Lady of New Orleans when the late Dutch Morial was mayor, historian Lawrence N. Powell, who wrote The Accidental City, Freddie William Evans, who wrote Congo Square, geographer Richard Campanella of Tulane University, Dr. Ibrahima Sek, academic director of the Museum of Slavery, Whitney Heritage Plantation Corporation, Carol B. Bell of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, and Priscilla Lawrence, executive director of the Historic New Orleans Collection, among several others. They were joined by the chairs of other tricentennial committees, from finance to marketing to community engagement. It was as diverse as such a group could be. After updates on a few projects and books and a general lesson on New Orleans history, including discussions on the slave trade, Reconstruction, the Plessy decision, and other key moments in New Orleans history, we moved into a discussion of how we want the outside world to view New Orleans at its 300th year and how we could use the tricentennial to move the city forward, almost as an organizing event, like you would do with an Olympics. It was all a lead-in to what I knew was going to be a sensitive topic, to put it mildly. A few minutes into my remarks, I recounted part of the conversation I had with Winton. I noted that symbols matter, and that I wanted to take down the Robert E. Lee statue. An audible gasp went up in the room. I'm not sure how many people were in that chorus, but as I recounted the steps I had taken since Winton's request, it surprised me to see a few African Americans who thought it not worth the bother, and a sprinkling of whites who liked the idea. But the opinions ranged widely. One of the first to speak up said she might be for taking down the statue, but that it could overshadow a lot of our work. "That statue doesn't bother me," said another African-American woman. She didn't think blacks were that concerned about it. As people weighed in with intelligent comments, pro and con, another African-American businesswoman offered some thoughts. A New Orleans native who had moved away for work, she hadn't given much thought to the Lee icon until her young daughter was in town with her one time to visit family. As they were driving along St. Charles Avenue, the girl said, "Mama, what's that statue up there?" The mother replied, "Robert E. Lee." "Mama, who is that?" "The general who led the Confederates in the Civil War." "Well, was he fighting for me?" "No, he wasn't. He was fighting to keep people slaves." "Then why is he up there?" The recollection of that conversation really hit me. As the meeting continued, with people suggesting that instead of taking down, we simply add things, a statue, for example, to civil rights leader Aretha Castle Haley on the avenue now named for her in Central City. A plaque that might put the statue in context. These were solid, committed people, people as good as they come in any city, wrestling with an idea I had delivered out of nowhere, just as Winton had done to me. And yet, what came home to me, through this candid discussion, was that no one said, "I demand that the Lee statue stay where it is." People debated, disagreed, but preservation of the lost cause was not on anyone's plate. But it was the story of that little girl that stayed with me, because Winton had asked me to think of it through the eyes of an African American. And now, I had heard about a young African American girl trying to make sense out of this statue in one of our most prominent places. That pretty much did it for me, because I was clear that my job as mayor was to prepare this city for that young girl's future. So I locked in. 4 of my 5 children were grown and out of the house by then, none yet married. We had no grandchildren. God willing, a grandbaby or more will come. I began to think of what I would say to that grandson or granddaughter years from now who said, "Papa, when you were mayor, what did you think of Robert E. Lee? Why didn't you take that statue down?" I knew I wouldn't be able to look that child in the face. I imagined her saying, "You had the power. You knew that slavery was wrong, and you didn't do it? Why?" The distortion of the past was getting under my skin. I made appointments with several of the wealthiest citizens in town, supporters of my past campaigns, including friends of my father, each a contributor to the public good, laying out the history of Tivoli Circle before Robert E. Lee reached the perch and my plan for a world-class fountain for a renamed circle after the statue's removal, I met a series of stares. One by one, even liberals were uneasy with the move. I left those meetings discouraged, wondering again if I was on the wrong track. And then, on June 17, 2015, the massacre of 9 people praying at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, left me stunned. A high school dropout and white supremacist goes into a house of worship to murder reverent people because of their color. My mind races back to the bombing in Birmingham, to the over 4,000 lynchings in the South, to Plessy versus Ferguson. The line is clear and direct, I thought. This is never going to stop. Do not tell me that this man's pathology is not linked to the lost cause myopia, which allowed generations of white Southerners to deny the acts of indecency and inhumanity perpetrated on black people. After so much progress made since the civil rights movement, what kind of country are we becoming? Are black people still, now, open targets in the South? As the sorrow and anger sank into me, I doubled down on my conviction that the Robert E. Lee icon must come down, and the statue of Jefferson Davis and Beauregard, and get the godforsaken White League obelisk obscured behind the aquarium off public ground once and forever. We cannot change the past, but we are not obligated to cave in to some nostalgia-coded idea that a statue is good because it's old. Symbols matter, and these were symbols of white supremacy, put up for a particular reason. I was not exactly stunned when the Louisiana Landmark Society, a historic preservation group, released hostile comments after a meeting of historians who were uneasy about the removal of statuary from an era of Louisiana history. The Foundation for Historical Louisiana in Baton Rouge opposed what we wanted to do as well. But then again, they oppose everything. I knew people in both groups and understood their aesthetic concerns in the abstract. But the reality was that moving a statue from one place of prominence to a museum or a park is a change in geography, not a form of destruction. It is also change with a message. We don't want this work in this place because of the dehumanizing message it sends to people of color, many of whom are the descendants of slaves. We must draw that line as a statement of civilization, that we have advanced in a moral sense to embrace ideas of liberty and justice. We cannot change events before our time, but we must view the past with an honest viewfinder lest we ignore the great moral injustice that brought us into this dispute. I felt emboldened when South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and Charleston Mayor Joe Riley, one of my mentors, in the wake of the Charleston massacre, decided to remove the Confederate flag from its position atop the state capitol, a Republican and a Democrat standing shoulder to shoulder. News coverage had shown the young killer posing with a rebel flag license plate and other racist symbols. The horrific murders, whose victims included State Senator Clementa Pinckney, a man much respected across the aisle, drove a shift among South Carolina lawmakers who lined up behind Haley and Riley. In May 2014, long before I'd started thinking about monuments, I had launched Welcome Table New Orleans, an initiative focused on race, reconciliation, and community with a cross-section of civic leaders meeting on a regular basis. Now, at the first anniversary celebration of the Welcome Table, as groups presented their projects, I sidled up to the edge of the stage. I apologized for wrongs that had been committed in New Orleans, specifically slavery, and I said that on this day, we should start to think about and discuss taking down the Lost Cause monuments. In a matter of days, New Orleans ministers, white and black, voiced their support. I didn't have the establishment behind me, but the many religious leaders gave me a surge of hope, particularly Sean Anglum, a white pastor of First Grace United Methodist Church, which stood catty-corner to the Jefferson Davis statue on Canal Street. The church had a sign outside that said, quote, "Take down Jeff Davis Monument," close quote, on one side, and, quote, "Black Lives Matter," close quote, on the other. Pastor Antoine Barrier, Pastor Charles Southall, the Reverend Marie Galatas, and so many others offered prayers, public support, and a strong moral voice to the cause. They would have my back. The city of New Orleans has a clear process to follow in order to remove a monument. The mayor's office, the chief administrative officer, and the superintendent of police must concur that it constitutes a public nuisance before the documentation can be presented to the Human Relations Commission and the Historic District Landmark Commission. The White League statue would also need approval from the Vieux-Carré Commission, which oversees historic preservation in the French Quarter, where the statue technically stood. Chief Administrative Officer Andy Copeland and Police Chief Michael Harrison embraced my position. The three commissions held long and widely attended public hearings and voted favorably. On September 11, 2015, City Attorney Sharonda Williams submitted a lengthy memorandum and dossier of materials to the City Council, whose support was pivotal. The hearings were pretty boisterous, even by New Orleans standards, with heckling and jeering from those who opposed the plan. One disgruntled opponent was ejected by police after giving the middle finger to certain members of the audience. But as various people spoke before the seven council members, I felt our presentation was solid on legal and moral terms. The most powerful speaker, I thought, was a Lakeview resident, Richard Westmoreland, a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel, who said that Robert E. Lee was a great general, but compared him to Erwin Rommel, the World War II German tank commander. "There are no statues of Rommel in Germany," he continued. Open quote. "They are ashamed. The question is, why aren't we? Make no mistake, slavery was the greatest sin of this nation," close quote. In a letter to the New Orleans Advocate, Westmoreland wrote, and I quote, "The heritage argument doesn't stand the test of time. These men were traitors. We are the United States before we are the South. How can anyone begin to think that these remembrances aren't offensive and disrespectful to African Americans? They are offensive to me as a retired military officer. They are offensive to me as a citizen. Our tax money maintains these sites. Their existence is offensive to me as a human being. The monuments to the Confederacy on our public lands are disrespectful at best. They are subtle, government-sanctioned racism. There is nothing about our heritage with the Confederacy worthy of embracing. We are not who we once were. We should be proud of that. We are our brother's keeper. I am white, by the way, a fact that shouldn't be relevant in this argument, but we know it still is." Close quote. A week before Christmas 2015, the City Council voted 6-1 in favor of dismantling monuments. We then began our procurement process, the term used for finding and negotiating with contractors for the work specified on city projects. Meanwhile, the Louisiana Landmark Society filed suit against our plan, citing its members' recognized interest in the aesthetic and cultural well-being in the city of New Orleans and in the preservation and maintenance of the four monuments at issue. The lawsuit, whose petitioners included the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, Beauregard Camp No. 130, and a group called the Monumental Task Committee, claimed that taking the structures down violated their First Amendment right to free expression, open quote, which they exercised by maintaining and preserving the historic character and nature of the city of New Orleans, including their monuments, close quote. I was sure that we had taken the proper steps in what, for me, was in its most simple form a property rights issue. Who has the authority over monuments on city land? The preservationists and their allies asked the federal court to overrule the city on an issue of its own governance. In good faith, I advised the judge that the city would take no action until the dispute was resolved, something I foolishly did not foresee taking long. Meanwhile, my staff and I were in dialogue with various construction companies who routinely bid for contracted work on city projects. With the FEMA funds we had obtained, combined with other support streams, New Orleans had at least $1 billion in work ongoing. One prominent citizen called me and pledged $170,000 for the removal cost, predicated on anonymity, allowing me to say that city funds would not be expended for the work. A Baton Rouge company that had done work for the city of New Orleans agreed to service the order for removing the structure once we were out of the legal thicket. I assumed the legal appeals would be tossed out soon. Before we reached that point, the owner and his wife received death threats, which were reported to the FBI, and his expensive sports car was set afire in the driveway of his business. The spread of domestic terrorism has many small stories like this. Threats, acts of religious desecration and vandalism that move across the news radar or make a few paragraphs on inside pages of the local press, and no one gets caught, or, if so, quite some time later. This is part of the ho-hum racism that eats through our country every day. In other words, we really haven't made it as far as we like to think. We're still mired in a mentality where they could lynch you, destroy your reputation, hurt your business, or engage in symbolic lynchings like a cross burned on your lawn or the car in your driveway torched. When the media reported the story on the burned car, I realized we were facing an opposition that went far beyond historic preservationists to a burning fringe of people bent on criminal behavior. As tension built inside me, a thought kept gnawing at me. How badly we had been taught about the Civil War, how little about slavery or Reconstruction or Jim Crow, for that matter, and how the ingrained racial attitudes I encountered in youth and through adulthood, in a city with such a wonderful mix of humanity reflected in the music and the cuisine, the balls and the parades, nevertheless, had a cold, dark underside. And it's not just New Orleans. You can drive 50 miles from here and find people in rural towns who felt emotionally invested in the Robert E. Lee statue as an idea of the Civil War, what the South was. Drive a few hundred more miles to outer edges of the South and find white people who think, open quote, close quote, the South is misunderstood, that the heritage of their ancestors or the idea of an honorable war, as taught in the schools and passed through the family tradition, supersedes why that war was fought. How else do we explain the blanket of hostility toward black people that shrouds the voting patterns of the white South? Has the white South truly reckoned with the Civil War? Think about the Southern strategy of the Republican Party as fomented by Nixon, carried on by Reagan, and now reenacted with Trump. Even with large black populations, no Southern state has a voting black majority, and every Southern state is schizophrenically split on voting lines of race, Louisiana high among them. Race is the great dividing wedge used by what was once the party of Lincoln to attract working class whites and country club conservatives who otherwise share few economic interests with each other, but are united against the interests of African Americans. I went through agony in those months of delays. A lot of people in this town who could have spoken in favor of my position kept silent. The issue had become so hot and controversial, I became somewhat isolated from most of my former white supporters and allies. The job became more lonely. I can fault myself for failing to anticipate the ferocity of the opposition, but I didn't expect that people would be so animated by the heresy of what I proposed that it would take a year and a half of appeals and litigation that went through 5 courts and 13, yes, 13 judges, all the way to the United States Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which today has become the most conservative appellate court in the United States. This is the same court where the venerable judge John Minor Wisdom, an Eisenhower Republican who lived off St. Charles Avenue, uptown, and in my opinion is one of the absolute saints of American jurisprudence, issued his legendary order to desegregate the University of Mississippi in 1962. Courts change as the politics of a region change, but the United States Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal affirmed our authority to proceed. Indeed, the city of New Orleans had the right to remove statues on its own public property that authorities of the city deemed a public nuisance. As the public temperature rose, the benefactor who offered to cover the cost of removing the statues called with a change of heart. He couldn't be associated with the project because if anyone should learn about his role, open quote, close quote, I'll get run out of town. The year and a half delay caused by the lawsuits, coupled with the burning of the first contractor's car and threats to him and his wife, had a chain reaction, and the contractors who did city work pulled back. Now I faced an issue that I had never anticipated, how to physically get the monuments down. With hundreds of millions of dollars in city projects, supported by the funds we had arduously negotiated from FEMA and other federal agencies to rebuild New Orleans, and with crews on job sites across the city, I can't get anyone to lease me a damn crane. This still eats at me. Of all the billions of dollars we'd spent on contractors in this town, I couldn't find one company with conviction to say, this is city business, therefore we should handle it. Are you kidding me? But the fear that the construction company owners felt was a reality we had to confront. And it wasn't just in Louisiana. We had called across the country. It was as if this project was blacklisted. The Confederate Monument partisans found a couple of brave members of the Louisiana legislature willing to declare all military monuments historically sacrosanct, putting rebel soldiers in the Civil War on equal footing with GIs who fought against the Nazis in World War II. For all of the chest beating in Baton Rouge, the federal courts did not bend their position as the appeals wore on. By the middle of 2016, as the lawsuits ate up time and energy of my legal staff, not to mention city funds, Homeland Security and the New Orleans Police Department were advising us to take extraordinary precautions as we inched toward the inevitable point when we would be free and clear to take the structures down. Protests at the statue sites were escalating. By late September 2016, outside agitators were a regular presence. David Duke even made a spectacle by counter-protesting a march to Jackson Square. We had hundreds of police brought in to keep the peace. There were only 7 arrests after several minor fights broke out. As we moved through 2016 and the early part of 2017, with the opponents' appeals running out of steam, we anticipated protesters on both sides of the issue to show up with banners, raise voices, and some alt-right figures carrying firearms. We were no longer dealing with a political dispute. This had become a security crisis. In City Hall, the mayor's office switchboard faced a tide of belligerent callers. Our receptionists, who took pride in their courtesy to callers, were subjected to profanities and threatening words, which the system was taping, the worst of which we shared with federal law enforcement. Despite the many other things that involved our time in running the city, the swell of hostilities created a siege mentality that wore on all of us. As we mapped supremely careful plans for the final push, I went home many evenings depressed about the worst impulses of a backward, bigoted South spilling into the city and my life. At home, Cheryl and I received obscene calls, just as my parents had in the 1970s when Dad was desegregating the city workforce. We felt the cold shoulders, the averted eye contact and gazes elsewhere by some neighbors and certain people we thought were friends. I had one of the most startling experiences while I was riding my bike in the park early each morning. I would be yelled at consistently by the same woman. One particular Sunday, it was more vicious and nasty than normal. You can imagine my surprise then when a few hours later Cheryl and I were at Mass and I saw her giving out communion. She was a Eucharistic minister. It was surreal. People who had served for years on civic boards quit. Even now, at a distance of nearly a year, I cannot forget the pain we felt, nor how hard it was on some days to get through breakfast, for all of the hatred sent our way, or for the deep, mean chill we felt when we entered a room for a public event. But when I got down, my thoughts always turned to the picture of John Lewis, at just 23 years old, standing tall at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, knowing he was about to get beat up by that sheriff. And then I kept going, knowing full well his burden was much heavier than mine. The harassment got personal as well. The way they hang you politically in the South is to accuse you of having black blood. It was something that scares people to death. Passe blanc, or quote-unquote pass for white, is age-old. So it was no surprise or shock to me that our political enemies would try to discredit me, my father, or my sister with this threat or accusation. Maybe I didn't know enough to be afraid. Or maybe I could have cared less if I had had black blood. Honestly, I would consider it a badge of honor. So when they dug up some records of my grandfather, Joseph Joffrey Landrieu, you know, the patient one, the one who untangled my fishing line, the one who loved me so much, and the one who dropped dead in front of me and said he had black blood, it didn't embarrass me in the least. He was one of the nicest, most decent people I ever knew. But the accusation is insidious anyway. Why does one have to have black blood to see that the Confederacy was wrong about history and humanity? Why does one have to have any kind of particular blood to recognize human hatred or misery or unkindness? This, though, is the kind of thinking that was so ferocious on the other side. Eventually, the state house bills to thwart our project failed to pass the Senate committee, and the clock was ticking on the final decision by the federal appeals court. I am thankful to the courageous legislators and senators who helped. Confederate statue sympathizers were holding candlelight vigils at the monuments to the generals. A racially diverse group called Take 'em Down NOLA, which wanted every street name, park, or statue associated with slave owning removed or renamed, was marching and mounting protest. Many of their principals had been involved in the movement for several decades. In early May, vandals spray-painted slogans on the base of the Lee Monument. Memory never dies. White supremacy is a lie. Take it down now. There were other ominous signs from the opposition. As the city's authority was finally resolved by the federal court, we knew that white supremacist alt-right groups would be heading to New Orleans. We put the removal bid documents out once and for all. We have to protect the identities of those who downloaded them. In the end, a single African-American contractor gave a bid of $600,000 for the removal of the three larger monuments predicated on law enforcement protection. Another city contractor said it could still move forward with the obelisk. The city accepted the bid, which was four times what we had originally budgeted, but understandable given the torching of the previous company owner's car, an event that had been well covered in the media. Here we were. More than a half a century after white mob attacks on civil rights leaders in Selma, Alabama, and a city lawfully preparing to move three statues and an obelisk had become a flashpoint in America's worsening racial crisis. How far we have come since those days in the 1960s. Yes, how far we have come, and how far we must go to see the fires of racial hatred ebb. On the advice of Police Chief Michael Harrison and Homeland Security Director Aaron Miller, I decided to dismantle the White League obelisk first, as it had the thinnest base of white support. We did it late at night on the advice of law enforcement to reduce the risk of attack on the workers. It would have made for nice symbolism on a sunny spring day, a contrast of the South old and new, for TV news to show the White League icon coming down amid the rollout for the Jazz and Heritage Festival, which celebrates the rich diversity of our culture. That was not a chance I wanted to take. The operation began at 2 a.m. on April 24, 2017. The police SWAT team had sharpshooters in strategic purchase with K-9 units circulating to ensure the workers' safety. Men driving the trucks, operating equipment, and other workers wore bulletproof vests, helmets, and face masks to guard their anonymity. Cardboard covered the company name on the vehicles and the license plates. All this to take down an icon to white supremacy. From law enforcement authorities, we learned that some people in the crowd were using high-definition cameras and hovering drones to take pictures, trying to identify the company and the actual individuals who were working. The obelisk was removed in several pieces, with the base of the structure put into a truck and moved to a city storage facility. One down, three to go. I do not smile over the composition of these words. Most Americans think of white nationalists as crude racists who show up at protests in their Nazi or KKK regalia. That is one reality. But the FBI and Southern Poverty Law Center track these groups because they amass military arsenals as one piece in the larger puzzle of domestic terrorism. As the city offered bids for the other contractors on the three statues, the companies on our list received escalating threats. Think of this. If you own a supermarket, a sports bar, a restaurant, or a car dealership, and people start demanding money for your protection, the legal term is extortion, being squeezed by criminals for protection money. We protect you so you can do your business. The opposite of this is threats to people who in good faith want to do their business. A contractor hired to take down a city monument is doing a job, not making a political statement. Companies with heavy equipment move and remove all kinds of things. When they get threatened before a job, it's a form of extortion. If you pull out, you won't be hurt. Your car won't be torched. No need to worry about your wife or kids. What the old line preservationists could not achieve in court, the Nazi, Klan, and white power radicals, under the proverbial quote-unquote shroud of secrecy, partially achieved by threats of criminal assaults. as threats persisted following Liberty Place, our law enforcement leadership realized that we needed Homeland Security support in order to thwart the white nationalist determined sabotage to the work of the construction companies filling an order by the city of New Orleans. We had five contractors, based on their solid record of delivering work on past contracts, on a standby basis for minor construction projects. We used a different contractor for the Liberty Place removal, and within days, that company began receiving threats. We knew we were being monitored by white nationalists. This is terrorism by any other name, despite what President Trump is too cowardly to say about one part of his open-quote, close-quote base. We had to regroup logistically. We needed major security assistance in a company that also had connections to provide the contracting work and a crane. When you think of what city governance means, how cities build and grow, the idea that a mayor with a work contract, backed by the federal courts, and a record of paying at least $1 billion for city projects, couldn't get a crane to remove symbols of white power, what does this say about the country that defeated the Nazi war machine under Hitler? Why have we fallen so far? Where did America get lost? To get that crane, I turned to outside help. I brought in a Texas-based consulting company with a solid record of providing security and intelligence service for the private sector and the U.S. government in some of the most dangerous places around the world. They were tasked with coordinating the federal, state, and local law enforcement to strengthen protection for the trucks, drivers, crane operators, and other workers during the removal. They also arranged for companies outside of Louisiana to do the work for which we were unable to contract with local or in-state firms. The simple removal cost should have been about $200,000. We ended up spending $1 million in public funds on security, about five times as much as the entire process of dismantling and removing the monuments would have originally cost. This could have been handled over several months in 2015 at a fraction of the cost had we not faced the lawsuits and the white terrorists. We spent another $1 million in private funds on the actual removal themselves. We learned through the security firm's operatives that alt-right groups had established safe houses in New Orleans where they were storing weapons. As we made plans to dismantle the Jefferson Davis statue, the site became a magnet both for white power advocates and for Take 'Em Down NOLA activists. On May 2nd, a group of Confederate partisans, openly armed, gathered at the Jeff Davis statue, trading verbal fire with Antifa activists who wanted the statues removed. The police arrested five people, defusing the violence, and erected barricades around the statue, gradually restricting the available space for protest. But those encounters and new waves of militiamen and alt-right outsiders escalated the threat of violence further, so much so that the FBI offered new guidance, assessing it was, quote, very likely that out-of-state entities with alleged nexus to domestic terrorist groups are heading to New Orleans, close quotes, for a major protest. Alt-right groups and organizations like League of the South were deeming the event the, open quote, new battle of New Orleans, close quote. Though tense, NOPD's work with the outside firm and the FBI paid off. There were very few incidents of violence, and the monument removal proponents outnumbered the other side. It was a small victory and also showed what we were really dealing with. A few days later, on May 11th, a day short of the 152nd anniversary of Jeff Davis's capture in 1865, the city removed the Davis statue. As Chelsea Brasted of NOLA.com Times Picayune reported, quote, when the monument was first dedicated February 22nd, 1911, the ceremony included a living Confederate flag, comprised of public school students, according to the Times-Picayune report at the time. The paper detailed the event before it took place, noting the exact cost of the monument will probably never be made public, but that the money outlay approximates $20,000. Adjusted for inflation, that number would be nearly $500,000 in 2017. 6 days later, the city took down the statue of General P.G.T. Beauregard on his horse, stationed in the small circular space just outside of the entrance to City Park. Of the four monuments designated for removal, Beauregard was the most problematic. In his later years after the war, he had become a reconciling presence, trying to help bring blacks into government, a position that caused him some ostracism before he died. He had actual ties to New Orleans. But the move to memorialize him, well after his death, ignored the latter-day liberal Beauregard to hoist the commanding rebel General Beauregard, leader of Confederate forces, onto a marble horse, hijacked into a symbol of the lost cause. Terence Blanchard, now a full-grown man, who had passed that statue many times on his way to school, was just coming back from a concert tour when he learned of the statue going down and went to City Park with his wife Robin and their two daughters. He took pictures on his iPhone. Quote, "This is something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime," he told a reporter. "It's a sign that the world is changing," close quote. As we move toward the final step, removing Robert E. Lee from the large white column at the streetcar circle, protests escalated. By May 2017, I had resigned myself to the reality that my original dream of installing some new piece of unifying artwork or a fountain of the highest aesthetic standards in place of the departed general would never happen before I left office. The legal delays, the white terrorist threats to contractors, the need to hire the outside security firm, the tense work we had done to allow activists their civil rights while working hard to defuse violence, all the added expense, the frustrating delays, security issues, and then the wrenching impact of these events on my family and me taken together, left me glad for what we had achieved, but disappointed that the beauty of the circle I had envisioned for the city would not be mine to execute. I leave this to future city leaders to finish this important work. In the weeks leading up to the dismantling of the Lee statue, I decided it was time to explain publicly, in a speech, why I had taken this course, to give the people of New Orleans some grasp of the history behind the monuments, and to set forth my position that symbols really matter, that they explain a lot about who we are as a people. I have given hundreds of speeches without notes and am comfortable in that improvisational mode. But I wanted these words to capture the memories, nuances in life, and stories of other people that brought me to this point. I wanted to give people a deep insight into what political power at its best can do, and the chance that democracy gives us to achieve change for the betterment of society. The speech was set for the afternoon of May 17th at Gallier Hall, the old city hall where Jefferson Davis had actually laid in state. Surely by late in the day, I figured, we'd have the Lee statue removed. As I finished the speech, I learned that the statue had not yet come down. Gallier Hall is just down the street from Lee Circle, but there wasn't a clear or safe line of sight, so for the next couple of hours, my staff moved a few blocks away to try to get a bird's-eye view of the statue coming down. We watched the local news, which had gone to near 24-hour coverage of the removal, almost like they would in a hurricane. It was only when I learned from the police that the statue was gone and there had been no riot that I felt a certain sensation of stress melting away. I felt a greater relief, but also sort of raw in the weeks and months that followed. I was hurt by the level of anger and hate that I thought we in New Orleans had finally put behind us. I can hear a few guys saying, "Well, Mitch, you led with your chin." I had won re-election 3 years earlier with a resounding majority of white and black voters. My support in the black community stayed strong, but I'd lost nearly half of the white support, according to the polls, since taking on the monuments. The speech gave me a great deal of favorable attention in the national media, but in my hometown, the tide has not so quickly turned. I hoped that in setting down my experiences and thoughts at length in this book, that many of those who once stood against taking the monuments down will think again and commit to working through the issue of race in our country after learning more about our real history. The long strain that Cheryl and I dealt with through this ordeal left us with a trailing sense of sadness as we realized that people we thought shared our belief in racial harmony could not go that extra mile. But it also taught us about the possibilities of change, and a few lessons about not writing off people with whom you've clashed. They may surprise you yet. Another way of thinking of it might be that forgiveness is elemental to getting along in life as well as in politics. I could blame Whit Marcellus for putting me in this pickle, but the truth is, he dared me, as only a friend can do, to take a principled stand and do the just thing, no matter what the political fallout. I will always be thankful to him for it. Politics does not provide many moments for an elected official to take a moral stand, realizing that you may well pay a political price in doing so, but knowing in your heart you've done something that will make you a better human being. Epilogue. Pope Paul VI in the 1960s declared, quote, "If you want peace, work for justice," close quote. Today, we hear his words with an altering twist, open quote, "Where there is no justice, there is no peace," close quote. I heard a lot about justice and peace at marches and from activists, especially in the wake of Ferguson, Baltimore, and Baton Rouge. No justice, no peace. My entire life, I thought that meant, if you don't give me what is rightfully mine, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to take it by any means necessary. I took it as an implied threat. I didn't really get that what it actually meant was, if everything is not fair, it creates alienation. And when people are alienated from each other and they can't share with each other what it is that they have, it is likely to lead to some level of violence. Poverty is a form of violence, I believe. So is not having access to health care or not having a real job so that you too can create generational wealth for your family. There is an institutional violence, as Robert Kennedy told us many, many years ago, that comes with there not being any justice. So where there is no justice, there can be no peace. A columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Jarvis DeBerry, put it more simply. The phrase, "no justice, no peace," is probably as misunderstood and misconstrued as the phrase, "Black Lives Matter." The same people who hear "Black Lives Matter" as indifference to other people's well-being are likely the same people who hear "no justice, no peace" as a promise to hurt somebody. If somebody says "no rain, no flowers," or "no pain, no gain," the meaning would be clear. The second thing won't happen without the first. The speaker wouldn't be accused of spitefully keeping flowers from growing out of anger at a drought. We all come to the table of democracy in the United States of America as equals. That's the aspiration. That's what makes America great. That is what everybody has a right to. That is what everybody is entitled to. But in order for you to get there, you've got to bring somebody along with you. This isn't what we merely aspire to. It's a truth that cannot be denied, that we are all better together because we all benefit from each other. We all have to go forward together or we don't go forward at all. Now again, just like no justice, no peace, that's not a threat. It's not a playground game where if you don't give me what I want, you're not going to get what you want because I'm not going to give it to you. It's not a sacrifice or a zero-sum game. If you win, I lose. It's an invitation for us to do better, together, to understand that we all benefit when we are truly at the table as equals. So if you're the mayor of a city and you want to take a culture of violence and turn it into a culture of peace, you have to produce justice, because if there is no justice, there is no peace. I only understand that today because of what we faced. It shouldn't have taken that kind of ordeal for the rest of America to get it. But as this writing was coming to a close, another lawsuit was filed to invalidate the laws cited to enable us moving the statues. Even after the statues are down, and even after what happened in Charlottesville, there are still folks fighting hard to revive the message of the lost cause. As I think about how to move forward, I am reminded of the many teachers on race and equity that I have been blessed to meet and engage with in my role as mayor. Brian Stevenson, Marion Wright Edelman, John Lewis, Barack Obama, Henry Louis Gates, Orlando Patterson, Cornel West, Charles Blow, Michael Eric Dyson, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Angela Glover Blackwell, Jasmine Ward, Judy Reese Morse, and so many others who have challenged me and fed my intellectual curiosity. I have benefited greatly from their work and, more important, their perspectives, even when I disagree, as I have sometimes. I will continue to be a lifelong learner on these topics as this is one of the best ways to understand and grow as a human being. I am often reminded of the lyrics of a song from one of my favorite shows, South Pacific, a brilliant musical in my view. I am still struck by the way Rodgers and Hammerstein handled the experiences of GIs on an island in the Second World War, a place where different cultures intersected and where we could see